I just want to introduce a guy who needs no introduction. It's been a delight to watch this man literally master an incredibly complex cannabis literature over the years. And if he should ever want to waste some time getting a graduate degree, I hope he would consider my lab. Let's welcome Paul Armentano.
Thanks, Mitch. And I really want to thank all the panelists that spoke earlier today. Some of those are going to speak later today. When I set out to craft the agenda today on the Cannabis Science Day, I really wanted to take a fairly unconventional approach to talking about medical marijuana. And I think you've gotten a feel for that already from Dr. Sulak's, what I would consider to be a revolutionary talk this morning, talking about the endocannabinoid system and what he called the synergistic shotgun, and how cannabis can help maintain our natural physiological balance. That's not typically the way we talk about medical marijuana, but I think it's an important way to begin talking about medical marijuana. And having Dr. Ryman and having Jenny Jenicek talk about cannabis as a potential exit tool, when right now we have the federal government claiming just the opposite, that's a gateway drug. And having Jehan talk about the anti-cancer properties in cannabis, when for decades we've been told that cannabis actually causes cancer, when we're seeing it's just the opposite. So with that in mind, I want to spend 5 or 10 minutes giving a short presentation that I call Moving Beyond Symptom Management. Because I think the conventional discussion of marijuana as a medicine still today is centered around this belief that marijuana or the compounds in the marijuana plant simply temporarily alleviate symptoms. And certainly there is broad applications for cannabinoids to treat symptoms. No doubt the popularity of this plant right now as a medicine stems from the fact that there are such a wide variety of symptoms that can be treated with marijuana. And many of you are already aware of those. But where I think this discussion really needs to go in the future, and what I think makes marijuana or cannabis or cannabinoids so interesting as potential medicine, is not just their ability to temporarily alleviate symptoms, but in some cases, their ability to go beyond symptom relief and actually treat underlying disease conditions. And we're talking about very significant families of diseases. We're talking about autoimmune disorders like MS and diabetes and Crohn's, which is a gastrointestinal disorder. We're talking about neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's and Lou Gehrig's disease and Parkinson's. As Jehan just talked about, we're talking about cancer. We're not just limiting this discussion to treating the side effects of chemotherapy or temporarily having someone boost their appetite. We're talking about the potential to treat cancer itself. We're talking about MRSA, multi-drug resistant infections, bacterial infections that have mutated to the point where they're now not responsive to conventional medications like penicillin. And as a result, people that are immunocompromised when they come down with these bacterial infections, they tend to die because we don't have the ability to treat or halt that bacteria from spreading. And we're talking about potentially the neurotoxicity and neurotrauma conditions like stroke or traumatic brain injury, conditions where blood and oxygen has been cut off temporarily to the brain, resulting in irreversible cell death. I highlight these families of diseases because in almost every case, these are progressive diseases. These are diseases that are going to get worse and worse over time. And while we've had research in these areas of diseases now, in some cases for many, many decades, and while we have many conventional pharmaceutical medications available to treat patients with these disorders, in almost all cases, those pharmaceutical conventional medications are simply masking symptoms of these diseases. They're not treating the disease itself. Or in some cases, like in chemotherapy, they're treating the disease in such a way that is so toxic to the patient that you often lose the patient to the treatment rather than losing the patient to the disease. So that's why I think it is so important to have this discussion and say cannabis, unlike so many of these conventional medications, not only has the ability to treat symptoms, but actually moderate the course of disease. And moderate the course of disease in diseases right now that we cannot alter, that we don't have the ability to slow down, that in many cases we don't have the ability to increase patient survival. I highlight multiple sclerosis when I have this discussion because we have the most clinical data on cannabis-based medicines and MS, and not just to treat symptoms. This idea that cannabis or cannabinoids could actually alter the progress of multiple sclerosis, it's not that new an idea. Price and colleagues were writing about it almost a decade ago when they suspected, based on animal models, that cannabis would slow down the neurodegenerative processes that ultimately lead to chronic disability and MS and other diseases that met this same criteria. And then in 2006 and 2007, we have two very important clinical trials published, one by Rogue and colleagues and one by Wade and colleagues. Both these were done in the United Kingdom. Both of these were done using the natural cannabis extract Sativex. In the United Kingdom, when you do a clinical trial, and like in the U.S., most British clinical trials are short-term in duration and their endpoint is a specific symptom. But unlike in the United States, in the United Kingdom, patients can elect to stay on the drug, the investigational drug that's being tested in the trial, after the trial ends. So in both of these cases, patients were using Sativex to treat symptoms of MS for a very short period of time, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks. And at the end of that time period, investigators looked at the data and they found that these patients experienced some short-term symptomatic relief. But many of the patients decided that they wanted to stay on the drug because they experienced this short-term relief. And to get into these trials in the UK with MS, you had to have end-of-road multiple sclerosis. These were patients that hadn't, well, they were not able to get out of bed on their own. So 2 or 3 years went by, and investigators went back to these patients that now had a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year history using a cannabis-based medication on a daily basis to treat symptoms of MS. And what they found was these patients reported that they continued to find relief from Sativex for MS-induced pain, which is a neuropathic type of pain, which is very difficult to treat. They had relief from spasticity. They had relief from incontinence, which is bladder dysfunction, which is commonly associated with MS. But what was really surprising was not that these patients continued to experience symptomatic relief from cannabis-based medicine, but that these patients reported over time they were taking lower and lower doses of the cannabis-based medicine to maintain the same level of relief that they had experienced at the beginning of this trial. Multiple sclerosis, like many of the diseases I'm going to talk about, is a progressive disease. People live with MS for quite some time, and as a progressive disease, the disease gets more severe over time. That means the symptoms of the disease, the pain, the spasticity, the incontinence, gets more severe over time. That means patients that are taking drugs to treat the symptoms of MS end up taking larger and larger doses of these drugs to maintain the same level of relief. That's not what we're seeing in the patients taking Sativex. They are taking lower doses of a cannabis-based drug while maintaining the same level of relief in a disease that should be getting worse over time. That doesn't seem to be happening in these patients. It appears that the administration or the intervention of a cannabis-based medicine has slowed down the progress of this disease. And to emphasize how significant that is, we really don't have conventional treatments that do that right now. And of course, in addition, the symptoms that these patients do suffer from can also be alleviated by cannabis. So we see in this case this dual effect, but what to me is most important is seeing what appears to be the halting of a very serious progressive disease. Also in the category of autoimmune disorders, we have diabetes. In this case, we're looking at a preclinical trial, and oftentimes when I have this discussion, we're looking at preclinical trials, and for the sake of time, I'm not going to get into the political and even some of the practical reasons why, in some cases, it does make sense to use rat studies, at least initially. One of the reasons that I will say is because you can genetically modify mice and rats to come down with almost any clinical condition you want to examine. In this case, we're looking at rats that were genetically bred to have diabetes. And this would be adult diabetes, which in the rat life cycle would be at 17 weeks. So these are rats that without any intervention whatsoever at 17 weeks will all have diabetes. And in this study, CBD, cannabidiol, this non-psychoactive cannabinoid, was used as an intervention. So they took half the rats and gave them placebo, and they took the other half of the rats and they gave them CBD. And at 17 weeks, not surprisingly, all of the rats that were given the placebo had diabetes. They should. They were genetically bred to have diabetes at 17 weeks. But significantly, 60% of the rats that were given the CBD intervention at 17 weeks did not have diabetes. So once again, we see a physiological change in the course of a disease. Without the intervention, they all have diabetes. With the intervention, more than half didn't have diabetes. And as anybody who has studied diabetes can tell you, we don't have conventional medications to alter the course of diabetes. You are diagnosed with diabetes, adult diabetes, your doctor is going to recommend that you engage in certain lifestyle changes, get more exercise, lose some weight, change your diet. Nobody's going to give you a drug to halt the course of this disease because that doesn't exist. But yet we see this physiological change when we have a cannabinoid administered. Crohn's, I said this is a gastrointestinal disorder. In this case, once again, we're looking at a preclinical trial. They take human tissue that's inflamed, tissue from the gastrointestinal tract lining. When you administer cannabinoids to the tissue, you see closure or relief of the inflammation to a degree that's much greater than you would see without the intervention. You know, anecdotally, patients suffering from Crohn's for decades have been telling us that marijuana alleviates their pain. Here we see a physiological response as to why that would be the case. And I really want to emphasize, when I go through these slides, I emphasize the physiological response. I think it's important to stress that because critics of medical marijuana, I think, have this belief that the patient isn't really better. It's all in their head. They just feel like they're better. The reality is we have physiological explanations for why the patient is, in fact, getting better. This isn't something that is in their head because of the euphoric side effect of THC. They are feeling better because their body is having a physiological response that is making them better. Alzheimer's disease falls into the category of neurodegenerative disorders. We have conventional pharmaceuticals that we might give patients with Alzheimer's disease, and they treat symptoms of Alzheimer's, but they don't treat the underlying disease condition. Yet we see that when we administer THC, that inhibits an enzyme responsible for the buildup of a certain type of plaque in the brain that right now we consider, to the best of our understanding, is the primary marker for Alzheimer's disease, and that THC, this cannabinoid, does it in a way that is superior to the available drugs that are conventionally available right now. And we see that phrase again and again, not just that cannabis works, not just that cannabinoids induce this physiological response, but they do so in a way that's better than existing drugs do. And I highlight this statement from Campbell and colleagues in the British Journal of Pharmacology, because I think it is so significant. This comes from the abstract of a review that Campbell and colleagues put out looking at the potential effects of cannabinoids to treat these sort of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. And I stressed it came from the abstract because the abstract is where you put your findings of fact. This isn't what Campbell and colleagues believe to be theoretical. This is what they believe to be true. And I premise these two sentences by, of course, reiterating to everybody that we right now live in a society where the federal government says that all of the cannabinoids in the marijuana plant, aside from synthetic THC, are classified as a Schedule I controlled substance, which means, by definition, they have no accepted medical use and treatment. Not for pain, not for glaucoma, not for nausea, not for appetite, for nothing. And certainly not for the conditions we've been talking about today. Yet, parallel that, or contrast that reality, if you will, with what Campbell and colleagues say, when they say that the compounds in marijuana offer a multifaceted approach for the treatment of Alzheimer's by providing neuroprotection, that means they protect the brain, and reducing neuroinflammation, that means they can reduce swelling in the brain, while simultaneously supporting the brain's intrinsic repair mechanisms by enhancing neurogenesis. Neurogenesis, of course, being the creation, stimulation of new neurons, something Dr. Sulak talked about earlier this morning. This offers a pharmacological approach for the treatment of Alzheimer's that may be more efficacious or more effective than current treatment regimens. So here, within two sentences, we have the federal government's entire lie about marijuana exposed for everyone to see. Not only does marijuana not have medical utility, it has medical utility in so many vast areas, including some of these very, very significant conditions. ALS, I brought Greg Carter in here, and he's going to talk about his recent work with ALS. Lou Gehrig's disease is a very significant, very serious illness. We do not have conventional drugs to increase survival rates in humans who are diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. Yet, once again, if we take mice and they are genetically bred to come down with ALS, and we administer a THC as an intervention both before and after the symptoms of ALS, we see in this animal model that we stave disease progression and increase survival compared to controls. In other words, you take rats that are bred to have ALS, you give them a placebo, the disease gets worse and worse, and they die from the disease. You administer a cannabis-based intervention, the disease does not progress at the rate it otherwise would, and thus you increase survival in animals. Yet we don't have human clinical trials even investigating the use of cannabis as a medicine in this indication. And Greg Carter has a terrific paper that he just published that he is going to talk about with you in a moment that explains the mechanism of action that gives you the physiological reason why we see this effect in animals when cannabis is used as an intervention and why we likely see it in humans with this crippling terminal illness. Jehan spoke about cancer, so I really am not going to say too much about this other than he was talking about GBM, which I wanted him to speak about because this is one of the most aggressive forms of cancer that there is. My understanding is most patients with GBM, they don't even give chemotherapy to. They administer radiation because the life expectancy is expected to be so short. And as he talked about, we see this anti-cancer property in this very aggressive type of cancer. But we also see the same anti-cancer sort of results in different cancer lines as well, like prostate cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, skin cancer, cancer of the pancreas, lymphoma, and several others as well. He talked about the mechanisms of action. He talked about apoptosis. He talked about the inhibition of the angiogenesis, so I'm not going to go over that again. I will just cite what Manuel Guzman and his team wrote in Nature magazine now, I think in 2003 or 2004, almost, you know, a decade ago. This is in one of the most prestigious scientific magazines anywhere in the world, and he explained this entire process. He said cannabinoids inhibit tumor growth in laboratory animals. They do so by modulating key cell signaling pathways, thereby inducing direct growth and arrest and death of tumor cells, as well as by inhibiting angiogenesis and metastasis. Cannabinoids are selective anti-tumor compounds, and that's really the most important part. It's one thing that they just have the ability to kill cells, but what's most important is they have the ability to kill cancer cells while leaving the healthy cells alone, as he talks about when he says that they can kill tumor cells without affecting their non-transformed counterparts. Chemotherapy doesn't do that, folks. And as he mentioned, there really hasn't been advancements in chemotherapy or treatments like chemotherapy in decades now. But we've known for almost a good 30 years that the compounds of marijuana possess these selective anti-cancer properties. MRSA, there was a study that was published in 2008 out of Italy where researchers isolated five specific compounds in marijuana. They they introduce those topically to the point of the bacterial infection, and what they found was that the antibacterial properties in marijuana were significant enough that they reduced skin colonization by these multi-drug resistant pathogens. And that, of course, is significant because by definition, these are bacteria that we don't have conventional medications to halt their spread. That's why they're considered to be multi-drug resistant. And particularly when you look at our nation's hospitals, this is a really serious problem. About every year, 20,000 people die annually from MRSA-related infections in the United States because we don't have sufficient conventional medications to treat it. The final slide I'm going to talk about is neurotoxicity, neurotrauma conditions. These are conditions like stroke and traumatic brain damage, as I said, where blood and oxygen supply is cut off to the brain, resulting in permanent cell death. The key in these cases, of course, is to get patients an antioxidant that will begin taking effect almost immediately because time is of the essence here. And once again, we have animal models showing that when you administer different types of cannabinoids, whether it's CBD or THC or others, in animal models of stroke, alcohol poisoning, and other types of instances where blood and oxygen is cut off to the brain, you see this neuroprotective effect. We saw it with CBD and ethanol-induced brain injury. We saw it with CBD and stroke. HU-211 is a synthetic agonist. This was a study done in Israel. It actually was a clinical trial. We saw better neurological outcomes in patients that suffered from TBI when they were given this agonist, and it was administered within close proximity to the time of the traumatic event. And then I want to highlight the study from Aidan Hampson and colleagues. This was done at National Institutes of Health, I believe, in Rockville in 1998, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In this case, they compared and contrasted THC and CBD with vitamin E, which, as Jehan said earlier, is considered to be conventionally a very potent antioxidant. And what they found was that the cannabinoids were protective against glutamate neurotoxicity in a manner that was actually much more effective than what were considered to be some of the best conventional antioxidants at the time. And this was considered by many researchers and many individuals that work for the federal government in a research capacity as a very interesting finding. And you don't have to take my word for it. You just have to see what Aidan Hampson and some of his colleagues did shortly after this study was published. They took out a patent on the use of natural occurring cannabinoid compounds as antioxidants and as neuroprotectants. And they were awarded that patent on October 7, 2003. It was granted to the United States of America as represented by the Department of Health and Human Services. So in other words, the very same government that right now keeps marijuana and all of its active compounds in the plant defined as a Schedule I substance without any medical utility at all also holds a patent on the use of these same substances to treat very serious and a broad range of medical conditions. And that ought to, in a nutshell, sum up just how fucked up and hypocritical this goddamn policy is. And that's why we're all here to try and put an end to this lie that we've been living under for decades. So with that, I want to turn it back over to the panel. And like I said, I really hope all of you, when you leave today, begin thinking and begin talking about medical marijuana in a different manner than you may have thought to talk about it before. Because this is a very serious medicine. To coin a phrase that's used way too often, this is a game changer, folks. So let's talk about it.